Good morning, everyone. We're going to get started this morning. If everyone could take a seat. And we do have a quorum, so the meeting is officially going. Let's see, Representative Breiland.
Madam Chair, I move approval of the minutes.
I thank you for that. Is there any discussion? Hearing none. The minutes, though, all those are in favor of the minutes.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Thank you. Any nays? Minutes are approved. Did I see Mr. Allen? We're going to get started because we have a lot of information with only an hour and a half to get to it. Don, are you start? No, Wes. Okay. Please identify yourself, sir.
Madam Chair, my name is Wes Koister. I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Chemical and Mental Health Services for the Department of Human Services. With me here today is Dr. Glennis Ed Wall, who's the State Director of Children's Mental Health, and Sharon Audio, who is the Director of Adult Mental Health. And I'm going to provide a quick overview, and they will follow up with more specific details about the public mental health system in Minnesota. I had the opportunity to present to many of you at the Joint Committee hearing chaired by Senator Marty the other day. And again, I want to express our appreciation for the attention that the House is giving to mental health issues and the formation of this committee. We look forward to working with each of you. I'll keep my introductory comments brief to leave adequate time for Dr. Ed Wall and Ms. Audio. So I will begin with talking a little bit about the issues and the challenges that we face. At the Joint Committee hearing, I mentioned many of the challenges and issues regarding the prevalence and treatment of mental illness, and I want to remind you of a few of these. One in four persons will experience mental illness in their lifetimes. Untreated mental illness is a leading cause of productivity loss and absenteeism in the workplace. 25% of our Minnesota Family Investment Plan caregivers, our primary economic support program in Minnesota, have a serious mental illness. 30% of the children in our child welfare system have a serious mental health disorder, and 70% of the children in the juvenile justice system have a serious mental health disorder. 16% of the adults in our correction system have mental illness, so it's clear that untreated or inadequately treated mental illness brings with it significant personal, social, and economic cost. While we are making tremendous progress in the development of community mental health services, we can continue to face many challenges. And again, I'll just mention a few. In the metro area, hospitals are unable to meet the demand for psychiatric hospital beds. This is driven less by the lack of psychiatric hospital beds and more by the need for additional community services that will prevent hospital admissions and, when hospitalization is necessary, support timely discharges after stabilization occurs. Our systems of care do not now support equitable access to mental health care and treatment across the state. This is true for both the public and the private care systems. Mental illness is a health care issue. It is a disease of the brain, and we know that it is critical to treat mental illness in the same way we treat other health care diseases. Health disparity studies and best practices call for the integration of mental health treatment with other health care services, but our public and commercial benefit structures and purchasing strategies do not adequately encourage or support integrated care approaches. Not only do we need to bring mental health treatment into the mainstream of the healthcare delivery system, we need to strengthen communication and relationships between healthcare and social services so that we're addressing the needs of the whole person. The existing financing structures for mental health are fragmented, difficult to understand, and unstable. This instability is compounded by the recent loss of federal funds and potential future losses of federal funds that we now face. We face many other challenges, including but not limited to the lack of mental health professionals in Minnesota, the need to actively develop culturally competent mental health services, the lack of employment opportunities for people with mental illness who want to be employed and need to be employed, and a shortage of housing options, especially in the metro area. Still, this is an exciting time for mental health. There are many opportunities that we have before us. The social stigma of mental illness is lessening. Innovative treatment approaches shown to improve patient outcomes are being developed, and more are being practiced. There's sound research on how to effectively serve children and adults with mental illness. Treatment has progressed to the extent that we can now emphasize the objectives of resilience for children and recovery for adults. More and more public policymakers are providing leadership in addressing mental health needs. This committee, the mental health bill recently announced by Representative Greiling and Senator Marty, the governor's mental health initiative are all examples of this leadership. Public and private partnerships have recently formed, and new ones are developing that will help us better address the whole continuum of mental health needs. Counties are beginning to forge new relationships with health networks to better identify and serve the needs of the whole person. Another of these partnerships is the Minnesota Mental Health Action Group, a group of consumers, consumer reps, providers, payers, and local and state government representatives who have been meeting for now for about 3 years to develop specific strategies to address the many challenges of the public and private mental health systems of care. The Mental Health Action Group has identified principles for a care delivery system that our agency has embraced. These principles call for flexibility in addressing the range of treatment needs, for providing the right service at the right time, for providing care at the least intensive site, for developing financial structures that are sustainable, for designing a system of care with understandable pathways that are easily navigated, providing treatment and care that is evidence-based, providing effective health promotion and prevention, ensuring that there's appropriate and sufficient capacity in our delivery and care systems, and establishing clearly defined accountability. These are rational principles because they represent what we want to apply to the treatment of any health care need or disease. We look forward to the opportunity to speak with you at a future hearing specifically about our mental health initiative. This initiative is based on these principles and it is designed to address the many challenges that I have mentioned. And Madam Chair, if it's okay with you, I'll be replaced at the table with Dr. Edwall and Ms. Audio, and then I'll also make myself available to you after their testimony for questions.
Thank you. That's fine.
Thank you.
And if you could identify yourself.
I'm Glennis Edwall, and I'm the Director of the Children's Mental Health Division at the Department of Human Services. Madam Chair and Committee, thank you very much for this invitation to be with you today. We appreciate it greatly. We thought that we would lead with children today, and trust that will be all right with you. I have prepared a brief outline of my remarks that's in the packet, and that I think will enable us perhaps to proceed in as timely a fashion as possible. I want to talk just a bit about the population that we serve, do some descriptions of core services, talk about the critical role of coordination between systems in the children's service system, very briefly about some of the innovations that we have been engaged in at the department, and then finish, unfortunately, with some challenges. First of all, our target population. The target population for the public mental health system has traditionally been the seriously emotionally disturbed child, and especially focusing in times past on the adolescent for whom a series of problems that led to involvement with multiple systems might have been likely to occur. Serious emotional disturbance is a definition that we have in both federal and state law that combines three aspects of the child or adolescent's presentation: a psychiatric diagnosis, a chronicity or a continuing course to that diagnostic information, and then most importantly, an impact on functioning in home, community, and school. Our federal service targets are based on prevalence estimates of various sorts and give us working ranges of 5% of preschoolers and 9% of school-age children that we ought to be serving, that are in need. Other estimates more recently are suggesting that those may be a bit on the low side, that we actually are seeing either an increase or better reporting so that we better understand a slightly higher prevalence rate. Our newer focus in both public and private systems, however, is based on an understanding that the functional impairments that help to comprise that serious emotional disturbance definition can be minimized or avoided with early identification and appropriate treatment. That this is a long way of saying, perhaps, that we have a better understanding that some of the core psychiatric symptoms have a clearer biological foundation, but left untreated, those same that diagnosis or those symptoms can unfortunately lead to accumulating functional impairments that make life much more difficult for the child and the family in across settings. Correspondingly, we want to try to deal with difficulties as soon as they can be identified. And so our newer focus we will often be talking about is to try to serve kids with emotional disturbance, that is the psychiatric diagnosis, but without the accumulating comorbidities. We, in Minnesota, in our public systems, if we look across both our Minnesota healthcare programs as well as services that are administered under the auspices of the county as the local mental health authority, we are serving, in the last state fiscal year, 42,660 children. Slightly more than half of those, 23,139, received some form of county service. Among those receiving county services, however, about two-thirds also were enrolled with Medicaid and received Medicaid-funded services. An additional 19,521 children received services through Minnesota healthcare programs, but without county involvement. I was asked to just very briefly talk about why we have a separate children's mental health orientation, division, and service system, and very quickly I just want to point out some of the differences between children and adults that have led to these developments. First of all, with children and adolescents, we are typically dealing with different diagnoses. While some of the more typical adult diagnoses do emerge in late adolescence and early adulthood, the children's system is primarily concerned with disorders that emerge much earlier, and they are often described as neurodevelopmental disorders. The most typical of these that you're probably familiar with are attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and the autism spectrum diagnoses. We also deal with different provider system to a large extent. Persons who are specialized in working with children comprise a different set of providers, by and large, than those who work with adults. We have different systems to coordinate, and I want to talk about this later, because the overarching coordination that is critical for children's success is between their health and mental health care service systems and the educational system. Not to succeed in school because of your mental health disorder obviously creates many more functional problems for kids. And we work with other young child-serving systems as well, but education is particularly important. There is a more prominent role for the family in the way that children's services are constructed and navigated. The family is critical in that their preferences, their needs, and their understandings of what their child and their family needs must be incorporated into the way in which we approach treatment. We also, in Minnesota, are seeing increasing cultural diversity throughout our population, but that diversity is growing most quickly among our youngest citizens. And so we have more emphasis on cultural diversity in the child population. And then, as Mr. Koistra described, we have a somewhat different understanding of what our fundamental goal is in the children's mental health system. Whereas a recovery focus has become a very important goal in the adult system, we really want to try to intervene with children before we need to be talking about illness and recovery as the dominant model. We want to help build resilience so that our children do not become as sick. The core services are described there, and I'll be very brief about this, but I wanted to lead by noting that the majority of mental health treatment for children and adolescents, and probably also for adults, actually occurs not in the formal mental health system, but in the healthcare system. We recently ran a study to see what services were being obtained by children in Minnesota healthcare programs who obtained psychotropic medication prescriptions, and discovered that 60% of children who have such prescriptions do not receive any other mental health service, including not even a diagnostic assessment. This is also true, we understand, in the commercial market, but it really speaks to the fact that we are not seeing all of the children with mental health needs in our formal service systems, but many more are being seen in the healthcare system. We proceed then for those children who are identified on the basis of a diagnostic assessment to the clinical mental health services that constitute the framework for our infrastructure. These are described in the Children's Comprehensive Mental Health Act, but they comprise a continuum from outpatient services to community-based rehabilitative services, which in Minnesota are largely those services described as children's therapeutic services and support for CTSS, to crisis services, day treatment, partial hospitalization, residential treatment, and inpatient hospitalization. As Mr. Koistra alluded to, in many of these categories, we have really uneven service development around the state and some serious challenges to trying to develop that infrastructure. So we are seeing, again, challenges in terms of inpatient hospitalization, hospitalization beds being inadequately staffed in order to absorb all of the need that presents to those hospitals. We also have seen real challenges to our day treatment system uneven implementation of a full continuum of the rehabilitative services. We're working on all of those things, but clearly those are challenges. Third, case management, which is the service most typically administered through and by counties in their role as the local mental health authority, which helps to pull together all of the services that a child and family may need, not only the mental health services, but also corresponding services that meet families' economic and social and housing and other needs. And we'll talk more about that in just a second. The county, under the Comprehensive Children's Mental Health Act, is also responsible for assuring an available infrastructure of services, an increasing challenge that we are trying to work hand-in-hand with counties to meet. And then fourth, for children, interagency coordination is absolutely critical. Minnesota's system of collaboratives developed through the 1990s was established to try to assure coordination across local child-serving systems. As we will note when we discuss challenges more fully, that system unfortunately is facing many such challenges right now. Services in other systems. As I noted, while we talk about core clinical services, integration or coordination across systems is very, very important. As I've already noted, coordination with education is particularly crucial. There is overlap between the ED and especially the SED population and children who are identified for special education, but it is not total. Various studies have suggested, in fact, that the overlap matched one way to the other is somewhere between 30% and 50%. So clearly, some of our children, although they have challenges associated with schooling, do not meet special ed criteria. On the other hand, we also have children who meet special education criteria, but who may not have been formally diagnosed or obtaining services in the children's mental health system. The school setting presents particular challenges for children that are similar to the challenges facing adults with SMI or SPMI in their employment settings. We need to start thinking about education as the work of the child. And if the child is going to accomplish that work, his or her mental health needs must be met and supports must be provided in the school context to make sure that the child is successful there. We have unfortunately hovered around a graduation rate of about 60% for children with SED for a great many years. Secondly, county social services. As Mr. Koistra also noted, there is a significant overlap between the child welfare and children's mental health systems in the sense that children in the child welfare system have a much higher proportion, a much higher proportion of them have formal mental health diagnoses and mental health needs. The reverse is not necessarily the case, however, and that often creates some considerable confusion for families and for counties, I think, in sorting out some of these problems. In the children's mental health system, what we may often see are families who are highly stressed by the conditions of their child's mental health disorder and are presenting for help not because they are bad or poor parents, but because it's really an overwhelming thing to work with. Finding the balance between understanding those parent needs and the child needs is certainly a challenge to those who are operating both systems. Families oftentimes, as I just noted, may need other county services as well, and so the provision of county social services to the family may be a very important part of filling out the whole picture for a child. I particularly note that with regard to housing, which we don't think of typically as a children's mental health issue, we know that homelessness is an enormous stressor on children, especially young children, and raises the rates of mental health disorders among children who are living in that circumstance. So clearly that we need coordination there as well. And then finally, with regard to this point about social services, repeatedly families have identified in various surveys and forums that the things they most look to the social service system for are respite care and crisis services as particular support needs. And so we need to pay attention to how we will fill that out. Mr. Koester has already talked about our overlap with the juvenile justice system, and you'll note there that every time we see a new study, it tells us that the proportion of children in the juvenile justice system with mental health needs is higher than the last time we'd estimated it. And so the 70% estimate is just sort of our latest good guess on the basis of research. Most of the kids who have a mental health diagnosis in the juvenile justice system, unfortunately, have not just one, but more than one. And most of them also have chemical health problems. We also know by the time kids get to the point where this is the intervention they're facing, that we have very significant racial and ethnic disparities in the children who are seen first in that system, the juvenile justice system, as a way of having their needs met. Well, that sounds like a grim story, but I want to quickly talk about a couple of the things, though, that we're very excited about. We actually have a lot of innovative projects that are just more than I know you have time for today. But I want to talk about two particular things that are sort of directions that correspond to this philosophical overview. First of all, I talked about primary care, first of all, because that is where the bulk of kids' mental health needs are first addressed, and sometimes the only place they're addressed. And so we have been working in a consortium of five states under the auspices of a grant called the ABCD2 Project, funded by the Commonwealth Fund and administered by the National Academy for State Healthcare Policy, to try to improve the quality of care in pediatrics and primary care for children's mental health. This project focused on very young children. The ABCD stands for Assuring Better Child Development. And the idea here is to make sure that we are watching carefully over children's developmental course, including their socio-emotional or mental health development. We had wonderful partners in this project, including children's hospitals and clinics here in St. Paul and CentraCare in St. Cloud, and found that we could really use the pediatric setting very well to monitor for problems, to provide anticipatory guidance for families, and with the presence of a co-located mental health professional, could quickly pick up, identify, and treat emerging mental health problems right in the pediatric context without having to access other systems. So we are looking for and hoping for expansions of that project. The other major focus area for us has been quality improvement issues throughout our system. I think I received probably the most backhanded but appreciated comment about this of anything we've done in recent years. And someone, when we were out and about in outstate Minnesota, said, "I really wish the state would stop trying to improve things." Well, in these particular areas, we have been really trying to improve things. We have become very serious about outcome measurement. We, through the MHAG context, identified new outcome measurement tools for both symptoms and functioning, and those are being piloted right now in 31 counties around the state. We have also introduced a comprehensive database of research on interventions for children's mental health disorders that was developed by the state of Hawaii. And we are now piloting that in locations in the metro area and in two multi-county sites that have received large grants from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration in outstate Minnesota. And we are working with our partners in MHAG for a public-private collaboration to create standards for service provision and documentation. Now, I've talked about challenges throughout, but I'll finish just quickly with these. Funding and resources for the children's mental health system is really critical. We have actually been in a position where, despite increased demand, we have seen decreases in spending throughout our system in the past few years. These have particularly, at the county level, we know, affected contracted services with the nonprofit providers and also the ability for counties to provide respite care. We have seen dramatic reductions, as I'm sure many of you are aware, in the primary funding source for collaboratives, the local collaborative time study dollars, due to administrative changes in claiming for those dollars instituted by the federal government. We are facing potential Medicaid changes that could also dramatically affect our system, particularly for the funding of targeted case management. And we have serious issues with provider shortages at virtually every level. They are the most acute for child and adolescent psychiatrists, where we rank in the bottom quadrant nationally, but also for child psychologists and others who can do good diagnostic assessments, for culturally specific providers, and for providers who are able to treat low-incidence conditions, such as eating disorders. And finally, I will end with fragmentation. Our system is often accused of being fragmented. I'm here to confirm that. But the fragmentation comes, unfortunately, from the best of intentions paired with the lack of resources. Because we have, indeed, tried to address children's mental health needs by jerry-rigging the system from whatever is available. If we don't have enough services or enough professionals to provide the services that are needed, then we are, unfortunately, but happily, using whatever services we can find that help to begin to try to address the needs. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. I think we're going to hold any questions members may have until after our next testifier.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Sharon Audio. I'm the director of the Adult Mental Health Delivery System. And thank you very much for the opportunity to provide you with an overview of adult mental health, the adult mental health system. In the time that I have available, I'd like to provide you with an overview of where the system is now, some innovative projects that we're working on, and similar to Dr. Ed Wilson's challenges we face as we continue to expand and enhance the system. In your folder, the left section of your folder contains an outline of my remarks, and there's also some additional maps which I will be referencing during my presentation. As Dr. Edwald mentioned, the adult mental health delivery system is really guided by a commitment to recovery. And recovery really focuses on a person-centered, strength-based system that enables the person to live a meaningful life in a community of their choice while working to achieve his or her full potential. The former administrator of the Federal Center for Mental Health Services and SAMHSA, I think, very eloquently said that what adult consumers of mental health services need is what we all need and want: a decent, safe place to live, a job, and friends. And I think that that really does speak to what many people, many adults in the mental health system, are striving for. Our emphasis is also on the delivery of quality services that are found to produce sound clinical outcomes for consumers to help them achieve these goals. And then lastly, we're also focused on strengthening and enhancing the services for the most severely mentally ill, as well as looking at how can we intervene earlier to prevent people from failing so that they receive the right service at the right time in the right amount as they access the mental health service delivery system. As Assistant Commissioner Kloestra mentioned, 1 in 4 people will experience a mental health disorder in their lifetime. Our primary emphasis for target population are two, actually: adults with a serious mental illness. And serious mental illness is defined as people who have, for example, bipolar disorder, major depression, schizophrenia, post-traumatic stress disorder, generalized anxiety, and who are functioning reasonably well in the community, but because of their illness often have cyclical episodes of intense difficulties and need hospitalization or intensive services. And the federal estimate of prevalence is about 211,000 Minnesotans who fall under that category. And then the second group are people who are defined as having a serious and persistent mental illness. These are individuals who have more challenges, people who have more functional limitations, individuals who have been hospitalized or have been under court commitment, and we estimate that in the public sector there's about 77,000 Minnesotans who meet that classification. Similar to, as Dr. Edwald said, counties are the local mental health authority for the adult mental health system, and they administer services, either provide them directly or contract with providers in their local community. I want to talk a little bit about the Adult Mental Health Initiative process, and there is a map in your folder, the first map of the state, that this began in 1995 and was fully implemented in 1995. 96. The Adult Mental Health Initiatives range in size from single large counties in the metropolitan area to an 18-county joint powers agreement in the southwestern corner of the state. And I see that Ms. Hegland, who is the director of Yellow Medicine County, will be speaking this morning as well, and she's a member of that group. The process really it's a voluntary process. It really encouraged counties to work together to look at planning and potential implementation of certain services across county lines. It also, I think, allowed for the development of some creative and innovative services that would not have been feasible in small counties that are facing really fiscal challenges. So this allowed for certain services to cross county lines, things like crisis services, for example, that in a very small county would not be possible potentially to do, either because of population size or funding. And what we found is that it really significantly reduced the reliance on institutional care. This design, in addition to a number of new services under Medicaid, which I will be speaking about shortly, have really been instrumental in allowing us to vacate our large state hospital campuses and bring the services closer to home, to develop the 16-bed community behavioral health units that are closer to people's home communities. So this has been very successful in reducing that utilization. Dr. Edwall talked about core treatment services, and I want to talk about the array of services on the adult side. There are some similarities and some distinctions for adult services. About 60,000 people have received some mental health service in the past year. Now, that could be just an individual service, and what we don't have data about was it the right service, and was it in the right amount, and was it in the right combination. But we do know that 60,000 adults in the public system received a service. Our core services are really divided into four kind of broad categories that cover the array of services. The clinic-based services, which perhaps many of you are familiar with, is the individual and group psychotherapy, medication management that's provided by psychiatrists or advanced practice nurses. Partial hospitalization is an alternative to hospitalization. It's an intensive, usually 8-hour day program so that people don't need to be hospitalized, but I get a really intensive service in the community, go home at night and come back the next day. And then day treatment services is a less intense but short-term outpatient service as well. Since 2001, we've added a number of new services to our Medicaid benefit package under what's called the Medicaid rehabilitation option, and I want to talk just briefly about four of those. You have maps in your folder that outline both where they are located, and on the back is a description of the service in more detail, which I will not go into for sake of time. I want to talk about the services that were first developed in 2001. The first service is an ARMS service. It's an adult rehabilitative mental health service. We have about 112 providers of that service now across the state that have served 11,000 clients who are reimbursed through Medicaid. It's a skills-based service, so it really helps people with skills training, symptom reduction, crisis management, medication monitoring, the kinds of things that people need to live independently in the community, support for housing, working with landlords and with others to help people live independently in the community. The second service that was established in 2001 is crisis response services. Prior to that time, there was really no adequate funding for crisis services. Counties that were able to provide that service paid for that in local property tax dollars. So there was really an uneven distribution of crisis services because of county fiscal pictures. This service is now a service under Medicaid. It's a range of service from mobile crisis teams, which are people who can go out to the person's home, go out to meet people in the community, as well as then having crisis intervention service that's a very intensive service, and crisis stabilization that's a period of about 7 to 10 days for people who really need to perhaps leave where they are and be in a safe setting for a short period of time. Clearly a much better service than in some communities where the police were the people who were coming to one's home when someone was in crisis, which obviously is not a good model of crisis services. We have about 20 of those. We anticipate that those will be expanding over the next couple of years. We're serving currently about 3,200 people were served last year through crisis. And then in 2003, with your assistance, we, as was true for the others, we established assertive community treatment teams. Those are probably best described as hospitals without walls. They're multi-disciplinary teams, small caseload sizes, 24/7 availability, provide the range of service that a person needs to stay in the community. And they're really focused on people who are having the most challenges maintaining independence in the community. There are the individuals who have repeated hospital visits, repeated visits to emergency rooms, individuals with co-occurring mental health and substance abuse problems, for example, people who are homeless. So it's a very intensive service for a narrow sort of band of individuals. It has been extensively researched. It's been found to be highly effective with reducing hospitalization or decreasing someone needs hospitalization, the amount of time someone needs to be in the hospital. We currently have 26 of those. The majority are in the metro area, though we do have some in the rural parts of the state, which we're really excited about. In state fiscal year 06, we served about 1,800 people. These are long-term services. There's no time limit, so the numbers you do anticipate are going to be smaller. Unfortunately, most of these teams are now full, so we really are looking at the need to expand this service. And then lastly, is the intensive residential treatment. We reconverted our Rule 36 facilities, which were not intensive services in the community for, and many consumers and family members said this is not where we want to live. They were larger facilities with a number of other people that they often had to share rooms with. The intensive residential was designed to be shorter term, intensive treatment, either diverting people from unnecessary hospitalizations or allowing for people to leave the hospital and be served in this setting before they lived independently in the community. In state fiscal year 06, we served 1,800 people in that program. As Dr. Edwell mentioned, we also have targeted case management services for adults. It's a brokered model, and it is limited to people with a serious and persistent mental illness. In state fiscal year 06, we served about 21,400 people through that service. Counties also provide general case management services for individuals who do not meet the serious and persistent definition. And then lastly, we have the inpatient hospital care. As I mentioned earlier, the development of the community infrastructure has really given us the opportunity to vacate our large state hospital campuses and develop smaller acute care hospital settings in the community. There are 10 planned. We currently have 6 that are operational and 1 that will be opening next week. We're very pleased with the average length of stay, which has dropped significantly to about 20 days. Which is really much more effective for people to have short-term interventions, stabilization as quickly as possible, and return to the community. In addition, and one of your other maps shows the contract bed hospitals. We have contracts with 17 community hospitals across the state to provide extended inpatient care, again, with the focus of if you can provide services closer to home, people need shorter lengths of stays, and can be reacclimated back into their home community. The average length of stay in those contract bed hospitals is about 28 days, and there were 650 admissions last year into those facilities. We also have some additional services that are provided through other agencies that we work in collaboration with. We have had an interagency agreement with the Department of Employment and Economic Development since 1985 to look at providing employment options for persons who have a serious mental illness. Currently have 26 extended employment projects which are in place to help people secure and maintain employment competitively in the community. We don't have enough of them. We have waiting lists for these services. There are 12 counties for which this service is not yet available. When you ask consumers, and the national data shows, if you ask consumers how many want to work, 70% will say they would like to find a job. When you look at how many people are competitively employed, it's less than 20%. So we have a long way to go, both in the employment side as well as on the mental health side. We have problems, I think, in the mental health community with people saying people can't work because they have a mental illness, and that's been proven not to be accurate. We have a lot of work to do in that particular area. Representative Greiling has been very involved with this process as well, and we applaud her efforts in this area. The second area that we have real challenges is in the housing area, and it's sort of comparable to employment. We have real problems with accessing safe, affordable housing for our population. We do have in place what's called a Bridges program. It's a temporary rental subsidy that's administered through the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency. It's a collaborative effort with us. They provide this temporary Section 8 subsidy, and we provide the support services to individuals. It's been in place since 1993, very effective in terms of helping people leave hospitals, leave more intensive settings to find a place to live in the community until their Section 8 subsidy is in place. With the reduction in the Section 8 subsidies and certificates, the time period between Bridges and getting a Section 8 certificate has lengthened significantly in the past several years. It's about a $1.6 million per year program, so it's a very small program in terms of numbers of people who could access that service. The other one that I want to mention regarding housing is the Housing Crisis Fund. This has really been very effective in terms of helping people who have no source of income retain their housing if they're hospitalized for up to 90 days. And what we've found in the past is that often individuals, when they needed to be either hospitalized or in a residential setting, lost their housing. And it was starting all over again each time. And you can imagine, if you think about it, that if you were hospitalized for a medical condition, lost your housing, and had to start all over again, how really challenging that would be. This Crisis Housing Fund has been exceedingly effective. It's easy to access. It has really made, I think, a significant difference in the lives of our consumers. We've found some reduction in lengths of stays because people have a place to go. In calendar year 06, we served about 417 people with an average cost for client of about $950. So it's a very inexpensive program, and it has really been very effective. And then lastly, but not the least important, is that we do have drop-in centers that are run by consumers for social and recreational activities across the state. We are also looking at the addition of peer specialists, which are consumers who are trained to work in various settings. And there are a number of these sort of community treatment teams that now have peer specialists on them, as well as other programs. It really is a valuable service because it's people who have been there and have gone through the process that sometimes understand better than we professionals do and really can address issues. I want to talk just very briefly about some current initiatives that are underway. The federal government has identified 6 what they call evidence-based practices. Those are practices that are steeped in research and have been found to be effective for people with serious mental illness. I've mentioned 2 that we are already involved with: supportive employment. The other is assertive community treatment. We also are involved with implementing integrated dual diagnosis treatment for people who have both mental health and substance abuse issues. About 50% of our population in the public sector, and that's growing, have both disorders. And it really is a no-wrong-door approach, because currently people were being treated in the mental health community, they get treated in the mental health community, they go over to the chemical health world, and it just is not a workable option, and we need to have a no-wrong-door policy. So this is focused on that. We received a grant from the federal government for a 3-year project, a $3.5 million grant, to really implement this using best practices, looking at harm reduction, looking at motivational interviewing, some of the new therapies that we know are effective for providing these services. We'll be starting that project in 14 clinics that are dually licensed for mental health and chemical health, and then we'll be expanding that across the state. So we're very excited about that grant. In the area of employment, we have two things that are underway. One is the Johnson & Johnson Support of Employment Grant. We're one of 11 states. It's a $280,000 grant for 4 years, and it really is to help the states implement evidence-based support of employment into their service delivery system, starting with four pilots and then making that statewide. Really with the focus on if somebody wants to work, you don't wait 6 months to get them a job, but you really help them access employment as quickly as possible. And then the second one that focuses on employment is the demonstration to maintain independence in employment that is being, that's a very large grant, a $54 million grant over a number of years that the department received from the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. It's administered through our continuing care area, but the focus, and we're jointly involved in this, is a set of comprehensive health, mental health, and employment supports for people with a serious mental illness who are working. And it's a way to help that group maintain their employment and their health so they don't become disabled. So it's really a very exciting project, I think, for us to learn about what are those services that people need who have a serious mental illness, who are employed, and help keep them employed in the community. We're working in conjunction with Medica UBH on this project, and it is focused in Hennepin, Ramsey, St. Louis, Pine, Carlton, and Lake Counties. We have done some work, although not enough, in our immigrant communities. We have two pilot projects, one for the Southeast Asian community that through Wilder Foundation, and then the other for the Somali community through COOC. And what we're really learning, which is probably no surprise, is that the mainstream mental health system is not needs to really rethink how we provide services to these communities. Diagnoses don't fit. Many people see mental illness with even more stigma than we do in the majority community. So how do we provide service? What's the best way to access service? How do we help people receive services who are needed? And then lastly, in terms of time, I just want to talk about a few challenges. Dr. Edwald mentioned the coordination and integration with mental and physical health care. It's true for adults as well that I think many individuals who are first seeking mental health services go to their primary care clinics and don't necessarily pick up the phone book and call their local mental health clinic. We really need to do more work in terms of co-locating mental health professionals in medical clinics. That's found to be exceedingly effective. We need to do more training of primary care physicians so they understand some of the dynamics in mental health. About 60% of antidepressants are prescribed to primary care clinics. When you look at how many people really fill their prescriptions, it's very few. How many people really follow through? So we need to do a lot of work in that area. And we have been working with our hospitals and other partners in this issue, around this issue. The other thing that is very disturbing is there was just a recent study that was published that indicates that people with serious mental illness are now at risk of dying 25 years younger than the general population. And that about two decades ago, it was 10 to 15 years. So it's increasing in terms of numbers. And it's not because of the mental illness. It's because of cardiovascular diseases, diabetes, respiratory problems, poor physical health care, exercise, smoking, the kind of whole range of things, which I think really does beg the question that we need to do better work with integrating with our primary care partners around mental health. The other piece that I will mention briefly is the continued development of community-based services. I think we've made significant progress over the past several years, but as Assistant Commissioner Koister mentioned, we still have problems with access to acute care, most particularly in the metropolitan area, that then flows over to Greater Minnesota. We have been working with the Minnesota Hospital Association, counties and hospitals in the metropolitan area over the past couple of months to really look at this issue. I think we are all in agreement that the answer is not let's add more beds necessarily, but let's look at where the need is in the community. We know, for example, that Hennepin County, which is our largest county, has a number of assertive community treatment teams they need about 10 more, and that's a conservative estimate. It's probably true in other metro counties as well. We still are looking for the right kind of housing options with services for populations. We find in our state hospital at Anoka, as well as in some of the community hospitals, based on a patient flow study, that there are many people sitting in beds who don't need to be there. And if we had the community infrastructure, we could move those people into the community. So we still have a great deal of work to do. We have more work to do on the front end in terms of crisis services. I think still too many people access mental health through emergency rooms, and we need to do more work around establishing crisis services. And then comparable to Dr. Edwell's comments, we need to do more work on culturally competent services. As the state becomes more diverse, we need to really identify what are the best services in those communities. And we also are facing a shortage of mental health professionals, most particularly psychiatrists. When you look at the mean age of psychiatrists, it's 55. We are not filling our psychiatrist shortage as people are getting close to retiring. So we are really going to be challenged. Looking at, are there other options? Advanced practice nurses can do a number of things. Can we look more closely at primary care, co-location of mental health services? Because I don't think we're going to recruit that number of psychiatrists to fill the need. So we have some real challenges and opportunities, but we look forward to continuing to work in this area. I think we've made some good progress, but we continue to have work to do. And thank you very much, and we are available for questions.
Thank you. While we ran over members, I do think that was some good foundation to start us off. Want to make sure, are there any questions that anyone has? If not, we're going to move to our county testifiers and have Commissioner Dorfman come up. Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Gail Dorfman, and I'm a county commissioner from the 3rd District in Hennepin County, which includes St. Louis Park and Minneapolis. And one of the hats I wear in Hennepin is as chair of the Hennepin County's Children's Mental Health Governance Committee of our collaborative. And I serve on that group with local school superintendents, head of our corrections and child protection departments, private agency folks, health plan representatives, and parents. And so thank you for this opportunity this morning to talk about the role of counties in Minnesota's children's mental health care system. I look back at the Minnesota Comprehensive Children's Mental Health Care Act that was passed in, I think, 1989, and it calls for a unified, accountable, comprehensive system that ensures access to a continuum of services from prevention and education to screening and early intervention. It calls for a system that's community-based, providing services in the context of where children live and go to school, and in the least restrictive setting. The Act also calls for a system that is sensitive to cultural differences, coordinates mental health care with other systems such as education and primary care, and a system that allows for a smooth transition from children aging into adulthood. And the Act also says we need to figure out how to pay for this comprehensive system through public and private means. And all that sounds really great, but the Children's Mental Health Act was passed in 1989, and now 17 years later, we still, as others have talked about this morning, have some pretty significant gaps that exist in the system prescribed by the Act. So, well, why is that? And we've heard about the fragmented nature of the system. The reality of our state-supervised, county-administered system is that most of our resources in the children's mental health system are focused on high-needs kids, those who have the most severe illness. They demand our attention because their needs cannot be ignored, nor should they be. And in addition, the 1993 Children's Mental Health Collaborative legislation prescribes that if counties form collaboratives to provide mental health services, children who are diagnosed SED, severely emotionally disturbed, must be served first. So in Hennepin, where we have as many as 13,000 children and youth with SED, maybe more, and throughout much of the state, counties focus on children with the most serious problems. These are kids who are most at risk, who use the most expensive services, such as hospitalization, residential treatment, correctional facilities, and they're kids who have the greatest impact on our other public systems, including schools, child protection, the courts, and corrections. Let me tell you just about one young man who I'll call by his initials T.S. Pretty typical case for Hennepin, I'm sorry to say. Both of his parents were schizophrenic. Their parental rights were terminated because they couldn't care for him. He was adopted at a young age, but in his early teens began hallucinating and exhibiting pretty bizarre behavior in school and in the community. His adoptive parents were eventually referred to county mental health case management. T.S. was connected with the psychiatric and therapeutic services he needed. The case manager coordinated a really complex system around this one kid, involving the parents, a personal care attendant, therapist, the school T.S. attended, multiple psychotic medications. And when T.S. turned 17, the case manager assisted the family and T.S. In applying for SSI and getting the initial CADI waiver. T.S. is now in a medical assistance MA-funded supportive housing. He's in a stable environment where his educational, vocational, social, and healthcare needs are being met and are coordinated by his parents and a team of professionals. And as I said, not an atypical case. It takes a lot of folks trying to navigate the system to put together the kind of care that this young man needed to be stable and to support his family. So Hennepin County and counties across the state offer access to a broad array, as you heard from Glennis, of mental health services to children with SED, from in-home and school-based care, the day treatment and residential programs, mental health centers, hospitalization, crisis services. Counties guide the development of this mental health infrastructure needed to serve the kids in our community. Counties broker the services through mandated case management services, and counties frequently are the provider and payer of last resort when no one else will pay. While counties provide some services directly, others are contracted out to nonprofit providers. And while all children should have access to some of these services, such as the 24/7 crisis and stabilization services that we now have in the metro area, only children with SED have access to the full array of service options if they're available. The system worked for T.S., providing the comprehensive set of services he and his family needed. But there's too many kids and families that are desperate for a solution and really feel they have nowhere to turn. For some, their private employer-based health insurance limits their mental health care or provides no mental health coverage. For other children and families, they're caught between dueling public systems, turning again to the county as a last resort. We see families so desperate that they resort to abandoning their children to the child welfare system or using the juvenile justice system as their only means to get the help they need. For the system to work for all kids and families, we need to provide the resources to implement the full mental health system prescribed in the original Act, one that is integrated along that continuum of care. For the system to work, we have to identify and remove the gaps in service and adequately fund prevention, early intervention, education, and care. Let me just highlight, and I know Glennis did this too, some of the gaps. Too few resources are focused on prevention and early intervention. Kids often have to get sicker to get the care they need. Mental health screening that could identify these problems early are pretty sporadic. While mandated for children entering child protection or corrections, it's not even a guarantee then that the services will be available. And then I just want to add, there are a whole lot of parents who don't want their kids screened because of the stigma of mental illness, which we can't ignore and sort of is the foundation for a lot of our problems. They don't want their children labeled at a young age. Professionals outside the mental health system who spend a lot of time with our kids, teachers, pediatricians, others in the community, they're often not trained to recognize the symptoms of mental illness, nor equipped with the tools to help families access the care they need. There are not enough mental health professionals working in our schools. Mental health professionals and the agencies that employ them are reimbursed for only a portion of the service they provide. The rate-setting formulas rarely cover their costs, and as a result, as we've heard, we face a shortage in mental health providers and clinics. There are not enough mental health providers serving culturally specific communities. With the demographic changes in our communities, we need to address that. And as has been mentioned, federal budget cuts have cut funding that pays for case management, school-based care, and many of the early intervention services that counties are trying to develop. MHAG, which, as you know, was a coalition of folks that is working for a better mental health system, recommend a transformation that integrates mental health care, primary care, and social services, and that provides that continuum of care from prevention to treatment and recovery. Building our community infrastructure and developing the capacity to achieve the MHAD goals is about creating a web of public and private partnerships across our communities. It will take time to achieve. Partnerships always take time to put together. But counties are really uniquely positioned to guide that development and are already doing so across the state. Let me just give you a couple of examples. In Hennepin, in collaboration with public schools and private providers like Washburn Child Guidance Center, has established a prototype for a system of school-based care that provides access to mental health services for over 80% of the children identified with such needs. By comparison, research suggests that only 30% of children receive needed care when the school recommends to a parent that they seek outside help. We are now taking steps to expand this model into our suburban system and additional Minneapolis school sites. There's 7 primary schools in Minneapolis right now. Several years ago, we established the Primary Project, which is a nationally recognized early intervention model for young children in public schools throughout Hennepin. It helps kids who are having difficulties adjusting to the classroom, and we work with our schools and community partners through funding from the collaborative, local school districts, and the county, and it has demonstrated that this model works in making significant improvements in the skills that will lead to successful school outcomes for these kids, such as really simple things that make a difference, like learning how to stay on task, to ask for help, making and keeping friends, and dealing with conflict without resorting to aggression. In our metro area, the counties of Hennepin, Ramsey, Dakota, Washington, Anoka, Scott, and Carver are working closely with private agencies, health plans, and the Department of Human Services to develop a 24/7 crisis response and stabilization service for kids. We meet regularly to develop common program plans and training of staff, and we have plans to establish a 7-county metro-wide single phone number and to launch an advertising campaign to make sure the service is known throughout the area. Ramsey County, working with the Community Action Program, Primary Care Clinics, and the State of Minnesota, has developed a partnership between children's mental health care and pediatric clinics, which I think is really critical, to help parents identify mental health concerns at the time their kids go for well-child checkups. That's the right time to do it. Mental health services are located in the clinics, and families are able to get quick and easy access to mental health care coordinated with the child's pediatrician. We're now taking steps to replicate this wonderful model in Hennepin. These initiatives would not have come about without the active role of counties. With the support of the state, we've been able to foster partnerships to build a children's mental health infrastructure that is beginning to work for all our kids, but we have a long ways to go. As you consider reforms this session, I urge you to take a look within your own county system, if you haven't already done so. See what's happening on the ground in your own communities. Understanding the role of counties and the challenges counties face is the best way to understand the real needs that children and families face in our own communities. Thank you so much for your commitment to tackling this very tough issue this session, for your commitment to mental health reform, and for the opportunity to be here this morning. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner Dorfman. Ms. Heglin.
Hi. Thank you. My name is Peggy Hegland, and I'm the Family Service Center Director in Yellow Medicine County. And I want to thank Sharon Audio for bringing a map, because you can actually figure out where I'm at. Probably the only one who knows is Representative Coonan. We're neighbors. I also serve on the Minnesota Mental Health Action Group, and so I've had that opportunity to serve with Commissioner Dorfman and the rest of the group as they have struggled with these issues of mental illness. Part of the advantage of going last is I probably could just say ditto, but what I'd like to do is gear this down a little bit and talk a little bit more about what happens out in my county, what happens out in rural Minnesota. As we said, we belong to the Southwest 18. That means there's the 18 counties in that southwest corner that came together back in those mid-90s and decided that we wanted to change the system. What we had at the time was a regional treatment center in Wilmer. We had three Rule 36 facilities, which are a short-term housing option for individuals. And I'm speaking, I'm sorry, primarily about adults now. And then we had a social worker case manager. Today, we have, in the making, I need to say, it hasn't even broken ground yet, but we are going to be getting a new CBHH in Wilmer to replace the current campus. We have two private hospitals, one who has had a mental health unit but has now expanded their coverage and services, and a new facility that's going to be developed in Marshall. And that will be a brand new mental health unit for us to utilize. And again, it always helps me to kind of look back at this map, and as I say these things, maybe what I should do is refer to counties, because then you'll see how our services are spread across a large area. Wilmer is in Kandiyohi County. Marshall is in Lyon County, and our third hospital will be in Nobles County. In addition to that, we also have the intensive residential treatment services that Ms. Audio explained to you. We have those, again, located across that whole area, which we now are able to utilize in lieu of a hospital bed, if possible. We have developed foster care homes, which we did not have in the past, and those are for individuals who have very high needs. Three of our homes actually serve people who came from the Agua Chang Nursing Facility. So you can imagine how severe those needs are, and we're able to do that out in Echo, Minnesota. Very small community. In fact, they are located in a farm site. We also have the supportive services that have been described, the ACT teams. We have four ACT teams, two of which are supported primarily by state-operated services contracts, one that has a combination of state-operated services and local mental health center staff, and a third one that is actually managed by the mental health center but contracts with SOS services. So we have a combination of services that show both the state and counties working very, very closely together. In addition to that, we have the other supportive services, the ARM services, the CSP services, etc., to serve people in their own home. Finding that home is an issue, not just for Hennepin County, but for rural Minnesota also. In addition to lacking the physical sites themselves, we have the same problems in not having facilities that can maintain the housing while someone might cycle through illnesses. But also a lot of the people we serve have some type of criminal background, and not many people will rent to a felon, irregardless of the services being provided. We also set aside dollars for employment services, supportive services, etc. And probably the most unique but well-received is our discretionary dollars. A lot of times we get focused on the idea that we have all these formal services that need to be provided, but if you can give somebody $50 to get that tire fixed so they can get to work, it makes a big difference. And so we can't forget that there are a lot of other small things out there that alleviate stressors, that allow people to continue to do what they were doing anyway. Some of the people that we serve, just to give you an idea, a lot of our referrals unfortunately come through the crisis mode. It's someone who has gotten so sick that they've ended up in a hospital, or we're receiving a call from a family member or a neighbor who is very concerned about them. These are people who are at the point of needing a hold order to go to a hospital because they are dangerous to themselves or to someone else. And that's probably, like I said, the first place where we get involved with them. Other referrals come from the children's service side with better and more active services with children. They filter up through the system, and a lot of times children will be referred from a children's case manager directly to the adult service case manager. Unfortunately, many of them come from prisons and jails and have been through the correctional system, and so we end up working with them also. What we do is provide case management, and you've probably heard a lot about case management. I like to think of it as the duct tape that keeps it all together. When people do come to our attention, we do the assessments. We work with them and anybody else who might know them to find out just truly what their needs are. We prioritize those needs. And then we work through the system to help people find what they need to be able to maintain a quality of life. That might be those housing services, those support services, A lot of times it's medication, it's maintaining those medications, it's finding a mental health professional that they can trust and work with. And probably the biggest thing is trying to get through the complicated funding system that we have in place. But personally, I have a parent who went through a medical assistance application. And I tell you, being in the system, I needed help. I couldn't do it myself. It's just unbelievable. And I know that's not your focus here today, but these individuals who are having difficulties at the time of their highest need, we hand them an application and say, go for it. So a lot of times our case managers end up helping them get those applications done, doing that Social Security, SSI application, finding the GRH application, et cetera, and making those connections between program and financing. For those that do not have insurance or are not eligible for medical assistance, it becomes a whole other picture. We do have some services whereby we can use state dollars, Rule 12 dollars, for example, grants that we were given, where we can purchase ACT services, ERT services, but not other services. So there are some gaps out there for people who do not have that financial piece. A lot of people talk about challenges. Mine are probably not any different than the rest of them. Again, the complicated funding streams that we have, and now the loss of some of those dollars, the lack of psychiatrists. If Hennepin can't find a psychiatrist, imagine who's going to work out in my area. Telehealth has been just a lifesaver for us, and we're getting into that, and I hope you continue to support that because that's our way to connect. Stigma continues to be a problem, and I believe that that's why we don't see people until they're in a crisis. They don't come forward when they could or should. Crisis response teams, I know you saw on your map that there are a number of crisis response teams. We do not yet have that service, and that would be an excellent service. What happens now is if that person calls and say it's your family member and they're having their crisis, unfortunately, law enforcement will come in the cop car and pick you up and take you to a hospital. And that's what we have to assure that they at least get to a service. The lack of housing, the lack of jobs, the lack of supports at jobs, these are all very expensive services. And even though we've made great strides in the last 15 years, we continue to have great needs. Just as a follow-up comment, the concept, the philosophy of putting mental and physical health together is like one of those great ideas. It's like, why don't we do this sooner? We hope to work in that direction, too. It just makes sense that people who have mental illness are not always able to get their health needs met either. So those are my comments, and if you have any questions of Ms. Dorfman or I?
Any questions, members? Seeing none, thankfully, because we're running out of time. We're going to move to our next testifier, and I do apologize. We're going to get to our advocates and consumers. I hate to say that hopefully we can get your remarks shortened, and then if you can be on your way up as our current testifier is finishing up so we can be as efficient as possible. Thank you. And if you can identify yourself.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Dr. Mark Coopy. I'm a licensed psychologist. I'm here as chair of the Public Policy Committee for the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs, abbreviated MACMHP, or like we like to call it, call it MACMAP. In my paid job, I'm Chief Operating Officer for Human Services, Inc., which is a community mental health center located in both rural and suburban Washington County. My focus today isn't so much about HSI, but rather I want to talk about the mental health system from a provider perspective, communicating with you about our association, the member organizations, the services they provide, the clients, and the challenges and opportunities that they experience in their work. Our association is made up of 28 nonprofits and two county-operated organizations. These are scattered throughout Minnesota with over 120 facilities and sites. We, too, have attached a map to our handout, which shows many of where the clinics and sites are located throughout Minnesota. Members of this association are community-based nonprofits or divisions of larger organizations where that division is primarily focused on mental health services. MacMap's community mental health providers together comprise the largest single source of mental health services in Minnesota, serving thousands of children, adults, and families each year. The members deliver a comprehensive array of services. They provide traditional services such as evaluation and assessment, outpatient therapy, psychiatry, group therapy, family therapy, as well as the more non-traditional services such as community support services, intensive case management, in-home family therapy and supports, rehabilitative services, wellness and medication education, and housing with support services. About 40% provide residential or inpatient treatment. Many of us provide services in jails or corrections, crisis assessments and stabilization in ERs or in client homes. Some provide home health care, and every week it seems that some of our members are busy developing new services on behalf of the counties, schools, or health plans, trying to meet the community's need that they serve. Collectively, MacMap member organizations employ about 3,000 staff. This is a mix of mental health professionals, including approximately 60 psychiatrists, 100 doctoral-level psychologists, 300 clinical social workers, 30 advanced practice nurses, 90 other registered or licensed nurses, a variety of marriage and family therapists, chemical dependency counselors. We employ many mental health practitioners who may be unlicensed staff, who work under the clinical supervision of licensed professionals in order to deliver program services such as the rehabilitative mental health services called ARMS or children's therapeutic services and supports called CTSS. These members also employ many individuals in order to staff residential programs as well as general operations and business office support. It is difficult to give a simple and clear picture of how all these components come together to provide quality services to clients. It is about being creative, using staff utilization and interaction. It's about bringing funding streams together to support many of these services. Here are some observations that might help. Because many of the supports and structure that previous speakers have addressed go into providing non-traditional services, they are either not reimbursed or inadequately reimbursed. We need to require staff to provide multiple services, pulling them in many different directions, with the hope that revenues produced in one service area will offset the losses in another service area. This is the downside of our business that can financially drain us. The upside for clients, however, with more acute and serious conditions, is that because we provide an array of outpatient services, therapy, psychiatry, we're able to combine those services with in-home and rehabilitation services, or intensive day treatment, or wellness and medication education when a program is appropriate. As safety net providers, we offer services to clients regardless of their ability to pay. We often have large uncompensated care burdens, financial losses due to a high volume of government clients with low reimbursement and high no-show rates. In addition, the severity of the client's symptoms and functioning require considerable time and effort to coordinate combinations of service and to consult with the family caregivers or other health and social service providers. As health plans have stepped up to the plate, improving their coverage and contracts, we have adapted some of these service models to both the public and private clients. Often earlier intervention, as mentioned before, helps avoid a downward spiral towards disability. There are many excellent examples of this public-private partnership that serve the public interest going on within our association.
Excuse me, Dr. Cooper.
Yes.
I hate to do this to you, but I see that you're reading your testimony. If you could either speed it up or give us some bullet points, because we
I'm
are
jumping past several of those, Madam Chair, so that I can get to the end quicker.
Thank you.
I appreciate that. It's important to understand that most every service program is financially supported by multiple sources, including grants for the uninsured, medical assistance from some, private insurance, contracts, and philanthropy to fill the gaps created by any of those above. If one leg of the stool is short, it affects the whole. I have listed several challenges that the community faces there. They include many of the things that have been mentioned before, like shortage of staff, growing demands, unreimbursable issues. Of all the changes affecting the financial health and viability of our core providers, the benchmarking survey that we completed recently based on our 2005 financial audits, the average margin for our members, that is the revenue minus expenses, was only 0.2%. This is where the rubber hits the road for the challenges that are listed in the handout. In the past few years, we have seen several bankruptcies. We've seen a couple of forced mergers. We've had many programs closed. We've had hours limited in terms of our operations. And the most devastating result of this has been limited access to our services for clients. Something is terribly wrong with the supply and demand on the business side of things. When community-based mental health centers have waiting lists for intakes and services, but we cannot afford to hire additional staff to provide that service. We have plenty of business, more than enough, but we can't stay in business by losing money on the majority of our clients. We know that we can improve outcomes and quality with therapists, psychiatrists, and community support by working together consulting, but our effort has to be on putting them towards billable hours, not talking to each other about better care. These are not insurmountable problems. There is a growing recognition that mental illness and emotional disturbance in children and youth is very treatable. People can recover. They can develop resiliency and do better, especially with the right combination of care and services earlier in their process. There is also recognition that mental illness, as stated previously, strikes every family, whether immediate or extended. It is part of the problem addressed by this legislative committee and other departments. Consider that depression and other mental illness is a major contributor to nursing home placement and extended stays. 30% of worker comp claims are stress and mental health oriented. Graduation rates, as Glennis indicated, for students with living emotional disturbance is far lower than any other population. Among those on the road from welfare to work programs, mental health problems is a barrier for about 30%. Our prison and jails are filled with people with mental health problems. Ask a family court lawyer about the impact of behavioral health disorders on family stability. Ask the HR department at your local corporation about the effect of productivity, absenteeism, and turnover. Talk to your son or daughters who are in college with their dorm advisors about the issues they see. Check a safety net hospital in the emergency room. Behavioral health problems are the second leading cause of uncompensated care in all U.S. hospitals nationwide. You can see why we're very happy to have this opportunity to talk to you about this. We appreciate the actions in the past that this legislation has done and the funding that has supported the efforts that we are doing. We have many opportunities. We know it works. We need to develop a framework to get the right services to the people at the right time and place. We can do this. We look forward to working with you, Madam Chair, and other members of the committee. Please feel free to contact us about any resources or things that we can do to help. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much for abbreviating your testimony. While the advocates are coming up, just wanted to do an announcement just in case members have to leave. As stated in the last meeting, for those of you that were here, there will be some Fridays that we go past the 10:30. We do expect that to happen for sure next Friday. We are anticipating an hour of doing housing and an hour of unemployment next Friday. So anticipate 2 hours for sure.
That the emails were, Holly.
Yes, Representative Riley. Thank you. If you can identify yourself for the tape.
Madam Chair, my name is Chris Flotten, and I am past chair of the State Advisory Council on Mental Health. And I'd like to introduce to you Ms. Natalie Kai, who is going to testify on her own behalf concerning services that she's received.
Good morning. My name is Natalie Kai. I live in Northeast Minneapolis, and I have lived in Hennepin County all my life. I've worked regularly since I was 17 years old, and now I'm 27. I have a diagnosis of bipolar, and I have been hospitalized about 6 times since 1999. I was in the hospital twice in the fall of 2005. I decided to speak today because I'd like to help others in the future not to have as many difficulties in getting help as I have had. It's been a difficult journey in terms of maintaining appointments, medications, and therapy. It's been difficult to hold down a job. I've had to revert to part-time work after working full-time for only 6 months. And part-time work doesn't pay very well, so I've been only able to earn just over minimum wage. That makes it hard to keep up with my friends who have full-time jobs and husbands and children, which are things I'd like to have as well. Also, I haven't been able to go to school full-time because of my learning disability. Lots of people have been very helpful and supportive to me, including my father, my therapist, and my psychiatrist. When I didn't have health coverage, my psychiatrist was willing to see me at least once a month for $5 per visit. I dropped through the cracks in the system and wasn't able to get the health care mess sorted out on my own. I had a case manager who didn't think I had a mental health disability. She said I had no chance in going through the appeal process with Social Security. She thought I'd be milking the system and said it was a conflict of interest for her to help me with my Social Security paperwork because it was her job to get people off the benefits. But both my psychiatrist and my therapist thought I needed to continue to get benefits and were very concerned about the idea of my losing access to health care. I'm not very good at keeping track of paperwork or understanding all the forms, and I often lose things like pay stubs and other stuff the county wants me to submit. I was turned down by MA but didn't understand why, and then was told I couldn't get onto Minnesota Care, but I didn't understand why. It turned out that I couldn't get Minnesota Care because I'd become eligible for Medicare. I hadn't understood about that. Anyway, I had turned down for health care. I tried to buy insurance through Medica, but was turned down due to my health history. I couldn't figure out how to get health care. My psychiatrist was able to give me samples for most of my medications, but after we finally got the health care mess worked out, I got a refund of about $800 from Walgreens for prescriptions that I paid for out of pocket. I had trouble getting the medical services and outpatient services that were recommended to me when I didn't have health care. I'd call to make an appointment, and they wouldn't take me even though my doctor wanted me to get certain tests and have certain things checked out. All of this was very stressful, to say the least. I've tried hard to get better and to follow doctor's orders, even when I don't like them. I like to go out at night and hang out with my friends, but I found out that I simply have to go to bed by 10:30 each night in order to have some stability and to be able to function and manage the side effects of my medication. Right now I'm having problems with my job. They think that I'm slow and that I don't do well with customers, so I may lose my job. This bipolar disorder is truly a disability because you need to take medication in order to better yourself, but the medication slows you down. So then you can't work at the pace that employers want you to be able to work at. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you very much.
In recognition of this, that we're running short of time, I prepared some comments, but you're welcome to read those, and I'll just end now.
Why, thank you. I appreciate that. I'm pretty sure the members do, too. If you can identify yourself for the tape, we'd appreciate it.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm Catherine Roach, and I live in the 64th Legislative District. I'm an advocate for NAMI, Minnesota, and I've successfully managed my mental illness for 22 years. I have bipolar disorder. Throughout this second half of my life, I've had unexpected and devastating issues with housing, employment, medicinal costs, and self-esteem. I'll begin with the most difficult topic, which is the medicinal costs. That category for me includes the coverage of my health insurance, regular doctor visits, therapy sessions, prescription drugs, additional neurological supplements like omega-3 fatty acid, and a Y scholarship to maintain some good exercise all throughout the year. Being the math whiz that I am, I've tracked my expenses for years, and this category, this medicinal expenses, takes up one-third of my income. My income, to begin with, is below poverty level. I receive SSDI, and I'm currently enrolled in Medica's MCHA program, Minnesota Comprehensive Health Association. I have to scramble to cover all my other expenses and limit others in order to make these essential purchases for my medicinal care. Number two category, my employment. Both keeping jobs and finding jobs, I have yet to establish an employment environment which rewards my good work, enables recuperation time when my mental illness rears its ugly head, and then embraces my return respectfully. My experience in a variety of work settings follows this path. I move through a good work period. Responsibility is taken on as a reward. My stress level increases. I try extra hard. I get fatigued. Poor performance develops. So a manager takes disciplinary action. I typically quit before I'm fired. Between jobs, I've worked with people at both the workforce centers and rehabilitative services around town. The services they provide are indeed necessary, but they're not sufficient for my becoming reemployed. I've developed additional relations with self-help support groups and mental health professionals. This brings me to number three. I have had a mental health caseworker in the past, and that relationship has been extraordinarily supportive. And at this point in my life, I'm no longer carrying that service, which I do regret. The caseworker relationship was useful during subsequent acute episodes of my mental illness and for ongoing support during the maintenance phases of my life. My final picture includes you. Imagine just for a moment that you take a 20-pound weight and attach one of those to each of your left and your right ankle. Now go out for a stroll or a walk or a hike. With this additional 20 pounds on each of your ankles, try not to let the pace that you walk be altered. No changes made. This is a tall order to fill. Not all of us are up to the challenge, but I ask you, will you make concessions for those of us that cannot keep up? I think you should.
Thank you, Ms. Roach. If you can identify yourself, please.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Carol E. Collins, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak today. I'm a proud parent of two sons, one of whom has had a serious struggle with bipolar disorder since he was very young. It took us 8 years to receive a diagnosis for him while watching him suffer. He first wished he was dead at 3 years of age, and by six was actively attempting to hurt himself. He had few friends and often cried himself to sleep. He was bullied to the point of having to be homebound at the end of sixth grade for 2 months. And then in eighth grade, he attempted suicide and was hospitalized. Finally, he got the help and diagnosis that he needed. And although he still has his ups and downs, he's been living independently for 2 years. If there had been early childhood screenings available, he may have had a happier and more successful school life. With early screenings, we all win. Fewer hospitalizations, healthier children, a true investment in their future and ours. Mental illness affects the entire family. Throughout this experience, I was unable to work full-time because of his needs. Many parents lose their jobs because of frequent calls from schools to pick up their child's out-of-control behaviors, and yet the child goes undiagnosed. 80% of married couples divorce if there's a mentally ill child in the home. For the past few years, I've been actively involved in supporting parents on similar journeys, and I frequently hear from them from across the state with questions on how to navigate this complicated system. On Wednesday, a mother called me in tears. Her sixth grader had fallen apart at a therapy appointment, and the psychologist said with his increasing inability to think clearly and perceive accurately, he needed to be evaluated by a psychiatrist immediately. The earliest available appointment is 2 months from now. Mm-hmm. By then, he may be in the hospital, or worse yet, be dead. Minnesota needs more providers. We need to increase reimbursement rates and consider other incentives, such as loan forgiveness programs, in order to make this state a more attractive place mm-hmm. to practice psychiatry and psychology. Earlier this week, a mother from northern Minnesota shared a story about a 15-year-old daughter with bipolar. Daughter was becoming quite combative at home and difficult to handle, and with two younger children in the family, mom and her husband requested respite care for 2 weekends out of the month at a cost of $190 per weekend. They were told, there are no funds left for respite care. We can't afford that. And 2 months later, she was placed in a group home. That's to keep the siblings and her safe at a much higher cost and at a incredible emotional loss to the family. This county, this same county, recently cut 80 children with serious emotional disorders from case management services due to the lack of funding.
It's time to fund respite care appropriately so that children can safely stay at home and in their community. Children's mental health collaboratives also need better funding as they play an instrumental role in supporting the child and family in the community. It's less expensive to keep a child home that leads to more successful outcomes than out-of-home placements. Crisis services for children need to be expanded across the state so that the first response is not the police and a possible trip to juvenile detention. Mental illness is not a crime. The crime is not recognizing it as an illness and treating it appropriately. You can't teach someone with a mental illness to not have it. Not with sticker charts, not with a reward system, and certainly not the penal system. The brain is the most complicated organ in our body. It stands to reason that it can get sick like any other body part, liver, heart, kidneys. Yet daily, parents are being faced with the decision to not pursue treatment for their mentally ill child or choose an out-of-home placement because their insurance won't cover the treatment. Those not treated often end up in the juvenile justice system or other out-of-home facilities. Parents are still being faced with giving up custody in order to receive care for their child, even though this practice is not technically legal. Every year, parents are left with fewer options and are often told their child needs to be much sicker before anything can be done. The sicker they get, the longer and more costly the treatment, the less likely it will be successful. I beg you, on behalf of all our children, take a serious look at where the dollars are going now and where they should be going to properly fund children's mental health programs in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Collins, for your testimony. And Ms. Boutte, you are our final testifier, and if you could make sure that your remarks are brief, we'd appreciate it.
Thank you. I'm Louise Boutte. I'm glad to have this opportunity.
If you could,
a lot of people,
I'm sorry, ma'am,
know
if you could
to talk about mental
ma'am, Ms. Boutte, if you could identify yourself for the audio tape, please.
This one?
Yes, just to say your name.
I'm Louise Boutte, Well Mind Association of Minnesota. We have never gotten any grants. Any grants go to the people who spend money, and I guess where they come from is from the drug companies. I don't know of anybody else who has any money. The drug companies are the only ones that don't have to negotiate with the United States government. They just say what they're going to charge, and the taxpayers pay, but they're not in the middleman deciding what they're going to pay for. Mr. Cuesta has been right about one thing. He says that the people who are labeled with mental illness need the same things the rest of us need, which is good health care, but we aren't giving that then. What they need is to find out, get tested with blood, hair, and urine, which tells them what kind of vitamins they need, and the hair samples tells what kind of chemicals are in the body, hard metals that need to get rid of. And we have gotten over what was called mental illness by using the traditional Chinese medicine from 3,000 years ago. You don't have to pay like the drug companies do, pay millions and billions of dollars to advertise, and they pay millions of dollars, billions, I guess, to do the research. The research, I don't think any of you know any of that. It's on the internet. The people who take the antidepressants, which are recommended for children, and a large percentage end up dead. There's quite a few companies are suing the Eli Lilly Corporation that makes Prozac and Zyprexa. There are now nearly 6 billion Americans disabled by mental illness, and this number increases by more than 400 people each day. A review of the scientific literature reveals that it is our drug-based paradigm of care that is fueling this epidemic. The drugs increase the likelihood that a person will become chronically ill and induce more and more severe psychiatric symptoms in a significant percentage of patients. Why does our government want to drug and disable its own citizens? It doesn't sound like we're living in America. Why do they force them to stay disabled all their lives? They hardly ever anybody is allowed to get out of the mental health system alive. There's only a few. And who benefits and who pays? Well, the people who benefit, I guess, are the ones that are dealing with it. It's all right to know all about mental illness, but I think that from my perspective, the only way to know it is to be locked up and packed away for a few years. Now, I got out in less than a year. But that was in 1955 when this Thorazine was due, and it was a wonder drug. But even so, the people there had compassion, or they had common sense. They let me, took me off of the drugs before they let me go home. So I had four kids at home. The oldest one was six. So now we don't do that. We don't let anybody get off. And if anybody, one of my sons made a lot of progress, and he went in back to the psychiatrist. I was having a lot of success getting him off the stupid drugs, and the psychiatrist saw how bright he looked.
Ms. Puta?
Made him very mad.
I hate to cut you off. Are you reading your testimony? Because can we get a copy of that? I do have a 12 o'clock.
I think I gave you two pages before, and this is another couple of pages. It's marked up, and I'll mail it.
If we can get that to our committee administrator, Jen McCurtney, we can make sure we get that distributed to the committee. And I do apologize for cutting you off.
Yeah, thank you.
Because it is my schedule.
I could have talked 20 minutes also, like the first ones did. And I don't think you've ever heard this before.
Well, actually, ma'am, I do read your mailing, so
yes,
I have.
You did.
not the newest one, but the ones that you have sent me in the past. So, yes, I have. But we will make sure that we get that to the rest of the members on the committee. And I do apologize not just for cutting you short, but some of the other testifiers right before you. I wanted to make sure that the department gave us an overview, since we are going to be picking up some very different issues for many of the individuals on this committee who have not had background in mental health. I thank you for your patience. Members, we didn't have a lot of time for questions. If you do have questions, please email them to me or to our CA, and the meeting is adjourned.